Consequently, when the biological Elvis died, for the brand, it was business as usual. Even today, fans still buy the King's posters and albums. Radio stations go on paying royalties, and more than 500,000 pilgrims flock each year to Graceland, the King's necropolis in Memphis, Tennessee. Prior to the invention of writing, stories were confined by the limited capacity of human brains. You couldn't invent overly complex stories which people couldn't remember. With writing, you could suddenly create extremely long and intricate stories, which were stored on tablets and papyri, rather than in human heads. No ancient Egyptian remembered all of Pharaoh's lands, taxes, and tithes. Elvis Presley never even read all the contracts signed in his name. No living soul is familiar with all the laws and regulations of the European Union, and no banker or CIA agent tracks down every dollar in the world. Yet all of these minutiae are written somewhere, and the assemblage of relevant documents defines the identity and power of Pharaoh, Elvis, the EU, and the dollar. Writing has thus enabled humans to organize entire societies in an algorithmic fashion. We encountered the term algorithm when we tried to understand what emotions are and how brains function, and defined it as a methodical set of steps that can be used to make calculations, resolve problems, and reach decisions. In illiterate societies, people make all calculations and decisions in their heads. In literate societies, people are organized into networks, so that each person is only a small step in a huge algorithm, and it is the algorithm as a whole that makes the important decisions. This is the essence of bureaucracy. Think about a modern hospital, for example. When you arrive, the receptionist hands you a standard form and asks you a predetermined set of questions. Your answers are forwarded to a nurse, who compares them with the hospital's regulations in order to decide what preliminary tests to give you. She then measures, say, your blood pressure and heart rate, and takes a blood test. The doctor on duty examines the results and follows a strict protocol to decide in which ward to hospitalize you. In the ward, you are subjected to much more thorough examinations, such as an X-ray or an fMRI scan, mandated by thick medical guidebooks. Specialists then analyze the results according to well-known statistical databases, deciding what medicines to give you or what further tests to run. This algorithmic structure ensures that it doesn't really matter who is the receptionist, nurse, or doctor on duty. Their personality type, their political opinions, and their momentary moods are irrelevant. As long as they all follow the regulations and protocols, they have a good chance of curing you. According to the algorithmic ideal, your fate is in the hands of the system, and not in the hands of the flesh and blood mortals who happen to man this or that post. What's true of hospitals is also true of armies, prisons, schools, corporations, and ancient kingdoms. Of course, ancient Egypt was far less technologically sophisticated than a modern hospital, but the algorithmic principle was the same. In ancient Egypt too, most decisions were made not by a single wise person, but by a network of officials linked together through papyri and stone inscriptions. Acting in the name of the living god Pharaoh, the network restructured human society and reshaped the natural world. For example, Pharaohs Senusret III and his son Amenemhat III, who ruled Egypt from 1878 BC to 1814 BC, dug a huge canal linking the Nile to the swamps of the Fayum Valley. An intricate system of dams, reservoirs, and subsidiary canals diverted some of the Nile waters to Fayum, creating an immense artificial lake holding 50 billion cubic meters of water. By comparison, Lake Mead, the largest man-made reservoir in the United States, formed by the Hoover Dam, holds at most 35 billion cubic meters of water. The Fayum engineering project gave Pharaoh the power to regulate the Nile, prevent destructive floods, and provide precious water relief in times of drought. In addition, it turned the Fayum Valley from a crocodile-infested swamp surrounded by barren desert into Egypt's granary. A new city called Shedet was built on the shore of the new artificial lake. The Greeks called it Crocodilopolis, the City of Crocodiles. It was dominated by the temple of the crocodile god Sobek, who was identified with Pharaoh. Contemporary statues sometimes show Pharaoh sporting a crocodile head. The temple housed a sacred crocodile called Petsuchos, who was considered the living incarnation of Sobek. Just like the living god Pharaoh, the living god Petsuchos was lovingly groomed by the attending priests, who provided the lucky reptile with lavish food and even toys, and dressed him up in gold cloaks and gem-encrusted crowns. After all, Petsuchos was the priest's brand, and their authority and livelihood depended on him. When Petsuchos died, a new crocodile was immediately elected to fill his sandals, while the dead reptile was carefully embalmed and mummified. In the days of Senusret III and Amenemhat III, the Egyptians had neither bulldozers nor dynamite. They didn't even have iron tools, workhorses, or wheels. The wheel did not enter common usage in Egypt until about 1500 BC. Bronze tools were considered cutting-edge technology, but they were so expensive and rare that most of the building work was done only with tools made of stone and wood, operated by human muscle power. Many people argue that the great building projects of ancient Egypt, all the dams and reservoirs and pyramids, must have been built by aliens from outer space. How else could a culture lacking even wheels and iron accomplish such wonders? The truth is very different. Egyptians built Lake Fayum and the pyramids not thanks to extraterrestrial help, but thanks to superb organizational skills. Relying on thousands of literate bureaucrats, Pharaoh recruited tens of thousands of laborers and enough food to maintain them for years on end. When tens of thousands of laborers cooperate for several decades, they can build an artificial lake or a pyramid, even with stone tools. Pharaoh himself hardly lifted a finger, of course. He didn't collect taxes himself, he didn't draw any architectural plans, and he certainly never picked up a shovel. But the Egyptians believed that only prayers to the living god Pharaoh and to his heavenly patron Sobek could save the Nile Valley from devastating floods and droughts. They were right. Pharaoh and Sobek were imaginary entities that did nothing to raise or lower the Nile water level. But when millions of people believed in Pharaoh and Sobek, and therefore cooperated to build dams and dig canals, floods and droughts became rare. Compared to the Sumerian gods, not to mention the Stone Age spirits, the gods of ancient Egypt were truly powerful entities that founded cities, raised armies, and controlled the lives of millions of humans, cows, and crocodiles. It may sound strange to credit imaginary entities with building or controlling things, but nowadays we habitually say that the United States built the first nuclear bomb, that China built the Three Gorges Dam, or that Google is building an autonomous car. Why not say, then, that Pharaoh built a reservoir and Sobek dug a canal? Living on paper. Writing thus facilitated the appearance of powerful fictional entities that organized millions of people and reshaped the reality of rivers, swamps, and crocodiles. Simultaneously, writing also made it easier for humans to believe in the existence of such fictional entities, because it habituated people to experiencing reality through the mediation of abstract symbols. Hunter-gatherers spent their days climbing trees, looking for mushrooms, and chasing boars and rabbits. Their daily reality consisted of trees, mushrooms, boars, and rabbits. Peasants worked all day in the fields, plowing, harvesting, grinding corn, and taking care of farmyard animals. Their daily reality was the feeling of muddy earth under bare feet, the smell of oxen pulling the plow, and the taste of warm bread fresh from the oven. In contrast, scribes in ancient Egypt devoted most of their time to reading, writing, and calculating. Their daily reality consisted of ink marks on papyrus scrolls, which determined who owned which field, how much an ox cost, and what yearly taxes peasants had to pay. A scribe could decide the fate of an entire village with a stroke of his stylus. The vast majority of people remained illiterate until the modern age, but the all-important administrators increasingly saw reality through the medium of written texts. For this literate elite, whether in ancient Egypt or in 20th century Europe, anything written on a piece of paper was at least as real as trees, oxen, and human beings. When the Nazis overran France in the spring of 1940, much of its Jewish population tried to escape the country. In order to cross the border south, they needed visas to Spain and Portugal, and tens of thousands of Jews, along with many other refugees, besieged the Portuguese consulate in Bordeaux in a desperate attempt to get the life-saving piece of paper. The Portuguese government forbade its consuls in France to issue visas without prior approval from the foreign ministry, but the consul in Bordeaux, Aristides de Souza Mendes, decided to disregard the order, throwing to the wind a 30-year diplomatic career. As Nazi tanks were closing in on Bordeaux, Souza Mendes and his team worked around the clock for 10 days and nights, barely stopping to sleep, just issuing visas and stamping pieces of paper. Souza Mendes issued thousands of visas before collapsing from exhaustion. The Portuguese government, which had little desire to accept any of these refugees, sent agents to escort the disobedient consul back home, and fired him from the Foreign Office. Yet officials who cared little for the plight of human beings nevertheless had deep respect for documents, and the visas Souza Mendes issued against orders were respected by French, Spanish, and Portuguese bureaucrats alike, spiriting up to 30,000 people out of the Nazi death trap. Souza Mendes, armed with little more than a rubber stamp, was responsible for the largest rescue operation by a single individual during the Holocaust. The sanctity of written records often had far less positive effect. From 1958 to 1961, Communist China undertook the Great Leap Forward when Mao Zedong wished to rapidly turn China into a superpower. Mao ordered the doubling and tripling of agricultural production, using the surplus produce to finance ambitious industrial and military projects. Mao's impossible demands made their way down the bureaucratic ladder, from the government offices in Beijing, through provincial administrators, all the way to the village headmen. The local officials, afraid of voicing any criticism and wishing to curry favor with their superiors, concocted imaginary reports of dramatic increases in agricultural output. As the fabricated numbers made their way up the bureaucratic hierarchy, each official only exaggerated them further, adding a zero here or there with a stroke of a pen. Consequently, in 1958, the Chinese government was told that annual grain production was 50% more than it actually was. Believing the reports, the government sold millions of tons of rice to foreign countries in exchange for weapons and heavy machinery, assuming that enough was left to feed the Chinese population. The result was the worst famine in history, and the death of tens of millions of Chinese. Meanwhile, enthusiastic reports of China's farming miracle reached audiences throughout the world. Julius Nyerere, the idealistic president of Tanzania, was deeply impressed by the Chinese success. In order to modernize Tanzanian agriculture, Nyerere resolved to establish collective farms on the Chinese model. When peasants objected to the command, Nyerere sent the army and police to destroy traditional villages and forcefully move hundreds of thousands of peasants onto the new collective farms. Government propaganda depicted the farms as miniature paradises, but many of them existed only in government documents. The protocols and reports written in the capital, Dar es Salaam, said that on such and such a date, the inhabitants of such and such village were relocated to such and such farm. In reality, when the villagers reached their destination, they found absolutely nothing there. No houses, no fields, no tools. The officials reported great successes to themselves and to President Nyerere. In fact, within less than 10 years, Tanzania was transformed from Africa's biggest food exporter into a net food importer that could not feed itself without external assistance. In 1979, 90% of Tanzanian farmers lived in collective farms, but they generated only 5% of the country's agricultural output. Though the history of writing is full of similar mishaps, in most cases, writing did enable officials to organize the state much more efficiently than before. Indeed, even the disaster of the Great Leap Forward didn't topple the Chinese Communist Party from power. The catastrophe was caused by the ability to impose written fantasies on reality, but exactly the same ability allowed the party to paint a rosy picture of its successes and hold on to power tenaciously. Written language may have been conceived as a modest way of describing reality, but it gradually became a powerful way to reshape reality. When official reports collided with objective reality, it was often reality that had to give way. Anyone who has ever dealt with the tax authorities, the educational system, or any other complex bureaucracy knows that the truth hardly matters. What's written on your form is far more important. Holy Scriptures. Is it true that when text and reality collide, reality sometimes has to give way? Isn't it just a common but exaggerated slander of bureaucratic systems? Most bureaucrats, whether serving Pharaoh or Mao Zedong, were reasonable people, and surely would have made the following argument. We use writing to describe the reality of fields, canals, and granaries. If the description is accurate, we make realistic decisions. If the description is inaccurate, it causes famines and even rebellions. Then we, or the administrators of some future regime, learn from the mistake and strive to produce more truthful descriptions. So, over time, our documents are bound to become ever more precise. That's true to some extent, but it ignores an opposite historical dynamic. As bureaucracies accumulate power, they become immune to their own mistakes. Instead of changing their stories to fit reality, they can change reality to fit their stories. In the end, external reality matches their bureaucratic fantasies, but only because they forced reality to do so. For example, the borders of many African countries disregard river lines, mountain ranges, and trade routes, split historical and economic zones unnecessarily, and ignore local ethnic and religious identities. The same tribe may find itself riven between several countries, whereas one country may incorporate splinters of numerous rival clans. Such problems bedevil countries all over the world, but in Africa they are particularly acute because modern African borders don't reflect the wishes and struggles of local nations. They were drawn by European bureaucrats who never set foot in Africa. In the late 19th century, several European powers laid claim to African territories. Fearing that conflicting claims might lead to an all-out European war, the concerned parties got together in Berlin in 1884 and divided Africa as if it were a pie. Back then, much of the African interior was terra incognita to Europeans. The British, French, and Germans had accurate maps of Africa's coastal regions, and knew precisely where the Niger, the Congo, and the Zambezi empty into the ocean. However, they knew little about the course these rivers took inland, about the kingdoms and tribes that lived along their banks, and about local religion, history, and geography. This hardly mattered to the European diplomats. They took out an empty map of Africa, spread it over a well-polished Berlin table, sketched lines here and there, and divided the continent between them. When the Europeans penetrated the African interior, armed with the agreed-upon map, they discovered that many of the borders drawn in Berlin hardly did justice to the geographic, economic, and ethnic reality of Africa. However, to avoid renewed clashes, the invaders stuck to their agreements, and these imaginary lines became the actual borders of European colonies. During the second half of the 20th century, as the European empires disintegrated and the colonies gained their independence, the new countries accepted the colonial borders, fearing that the alternative would be endless wars and conflicts. Many of the difficulties faced by present-day African countries stem from the fact that their borders make little sense. When the written fantasies of European bureaucracies encountered the African reality, reality was forced to surrender. The modern educational system provides numerous other examples of reality bowing down to written records. When measuring the width of my desk, the yardstick I am using matters little. My desk remains the same width, regardless of whether I say it is 200 centimetres or 78.74 inches. However, when bureaucracies measure people, the yardsticks they choose make all the difference. When schools began assessing people according to precise marks, the lives of millions of students and teachers changed dramatically. Marks are a relatively new invention. Hunter-gatherers were never marked for their achievements, and even thousands of years after the agricultural revolution, few educational establishments used precise marks. A medieval apprentice cobbler did not receive at the end of the year a piece of paper saying he has got an A on shoelaces, but a C- on buckles. An undergraduate in Shakespeare's day left Oxford with one of only two possible results, with a degree or without one. Nobody thought of giving one student a final mark of 74 and another student 88. Only the mass educational systems of the industrial age began using precise marks on a regular basis. Since both factories and government ministries became accustomed to thinking in the language of numbers, schools followed suit. They started to gauge the worth of each student according to his or her average mark, whereas the worth of each teacher and principal was judged according to the school's overall average. Once bureaucrats adopted this yardstick, reality was transformed. Originally, schools were supposed to focus on enlightening and educating students, and marks were merely a means of measuring success. But, naturally enough, schools soon began focusing on getting high marks. As every child, teacher, and inspector knows, the skills required to get high marks in an exam are not the same as a true understanding of literature, biology, or mathematics. Every child, teacher, and inspector also knows that when forced to choose between the two, most schools will go for the marks. The power of written records reached its apogee with the appearance of holy scriptures. Priests and scribes in ancient civilizations got used to seeing documents as guidebooks for reality. At first, the texts told them about the reality of taxes, fields, and granaries. But as the bureaucracy gained power, so the texts gained authority. Priests wrote down not just the gods' property list, but also the gods' deeds, commandments, and secrets. The resulting scriptures purported to describe reality in its entirety, and generations of scholars became accustomed to looking for all the answers in the pages of the Bible, the Quran, or the Vedas. In theory, if some holy book misrepresented reality, its disciples would sooner or later find it out, and the text would lose its authority. Abraham Lincoln said you cannot deceive everybody all the time. Well, that's wishful thinking. In practice, the power of human cooperation networks rests on a delicate balance between truth and fiction. If you distort reality too much, it will weaken you, and you will not be able to compete against more clear-sighted rivals. On the other hand, you cannot organize masses of people effectively without relying on some fictional myths. So if you stick to pure reality without mixing any fiction with it, few people would follow you. If you used a time machine to send a modern scientist to ancient Egypt, she would not be able to seize power by exposing the fictions of the local priests and lecturing the peasants on evolution, relativity, and quantum physics. Of course, if our scientist could use her knowledge in order to produce a few rifles and artillery pieces, she could gain a huge advantage over Pharaoh and the crocodile god Sobek. Yet, in order to mine iron, build furnaces, and manufacture gunpowder, the scientist would need a lot of hard-working peasants. Do you really think she could inspire them by explaining that energy divided by mass equals the speed of light squared? If you happen to think so, you are welcome to travel to Afghanistan or Syria and try your luck. Really powerful human organizations, such as pharaonic Egypt, communist China, the European empires, and the modern school system, are not necessarily clear-sighted. Much of their power rests on their ability to force their fictional beliefs on a submissive reality. That's the whole idea of money, for example. The government takes worthless pieces of paper, declares them to be valuable, and then uses them to compute the value of everything else. The government has enough power to force citizens to pay taxes using these pieces of paper. So the citizens have no choice but to get their hand on at least some bills. The bills consequently become really valuable. The government officials are vindicated in their beliefs, and since the government controls the issuing of paper money, its power grows. If somebody protests that these are just worthless pieces of paper, and behaves as if they are only pieces of paper, he won't get very far in life. The same thing happens when the educational system declares that matriculation exams are the best method to evaluate students. The system has enough authority to influence acceptance conditions to colleges, government offices, and private sector jobs. Students, therefore, invest all their efforts in getting good marks. Coveted positions are manned by people with high marks, who naturally support the system that brought them there. The fact that the educational system controls the critical exams gives it more power and increases its influence over colleges, government offices, and the job market. If somebody protests that the degree certificate is just a piece of paper and behaves accordingly, he is unlikely to get very far in life. Holy scriptures work the same way. The religious establishment proclaims that the holy book contains the answers to all our questions. It simultaneously forces courts, governments, and businesses to behave according to what the holy book says. When a wise person reads scriptures and then looks at the world, he sees that there is indeed a good match. Scriptures say that you must pay tithes to God, and look, everybody pays. Scriptures say that women are inferior to men and cannot serve as judges or even give testimony in court. And look, there are indeed no women judges, and the courts reject their testimony. Scriptures say that whoever studies the word of God will succeed in life. And look, all the good jobs are indeed held by people who know the holy book by heart. Such a wise person will naturally begin to study the holy book, and because he is wise, he will become a scriptural pundit. He will consequently be appointed a judge. When he becomes a judge, he will not allow women to bear witness in court, and when he chooses his successor, he will obviously pick somebody who knows the holy book well. If someone protests that this book is just paper, and behaves accordingly, such a heretic will not get very far in life. Even when scriptures mislead people about the true nature of reality, they can nevertheless retain their authority for thousands of years. For instance, the biblical perception of history is fundamentally flawed, yet it managed to spread throughout the world, and billions still believe in it. The Bible peddled a monotheistic theory of history, which says that the world is governed by a single, all-powerful deity, who cares above all else about me and my doings. If something good happens, it must be a reward for my good deeds. Any catastrophe must surely be punishment for my sins. Thus, the ancient Jews believed that if they suffered from drought, or if King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylonia invaded Judea and exiled its people, surely these were divine punishments for their own sins. And if King Cyrus of Persia defeated the Babylonians and allowed the Jewish exiles to return home and rebuild Jerusalem, God in his mercy must have heard their remorseful prayers. The Bible doesn't recognize the possibility that perhaps the drought resulted from a volcanic eruption in the Philippines, that Nebuchadnezzar invaded in pursuit of Babylonian commercial interests, and that King Cyrus had his own political reasons to favor the Jews. The Bible accordingly shows no interest whatsoever in understanding the global ecology, the Babylonian economy, or the Persian political system. Such self-absorption characterizes all humans in their childhood. Children of all religions and cultures think they are the center of the world, and therefore show little genuine interest in the conditions and feelings of other people. That's why divorce is so traumatic for children. A 5-year-old cannot understand that something important is happening for reasons unrelated to him. No matter how many times you tell him that Mummy and Daddy are independent people with their own problems and wishes, and that they didn't divorce because of him, the child cannot absorb that. He is convinced that everything happens because of him. Most people grow out of this infantile delusion. Monotheists hold on to it till the day they die. Like a child thinking that his parents are fighting because of him, the monotheist is convinced that the Persians are fighting the Babylonians because of him. Already in biblical times, some cultures had a far more accurate perception of history. Animist and polytheist religions depicted the world as the playground of numerous different powers rather than a single god. It was consequently easy for animists and polytheists to accept that many events are unrelated to me or to my favorite deity, and they are neither punishments for my sins nor rewards for my good deeds. Greek historians, such as Herodotus and Thucydides, and Chinese historians, such as Sima Xian, developed sophisticated theories of history which are very similar to our own modern views. They explained that wars and revolutions break out due to a plethora of political, social, and economic factors. People may fall victim to a war for no fault of their own. Accordingly, Herodotus showed keen interest in understanding Persian politics, while Sima Xian was very concerned about the culture and religion of barbarous steppe people. Present-day scholars agree with Herodotus and Sima Xian rather than with the Bible. That's why all modern states invest so much effort in collecting information about other countries and in analyzing global ecological, political, and economic trends. When the U.S. economy falters, even evangelical Republicans sometimes point an accusing finger at China rather than at their own sins. Yet even though Herodotus and Thucydides understood reality much better than the authors of the Bible, when the two worldviews collided, the Bible won by a knockout. The Greeks adopted the Jewish view of history rather than vice versa. 1,000 years after Thucydides, the Greeks became convinced that if some barbarian horde invaded, surely it was divine punishment for their sins. No matter how mistaken the biblical worldview was, it provided a better basis for large-scale human cooperation. But it works. Fictions enable us to cooperate better. The price we pay is that the same fictions also determine the goals of our cooperation. So we may have very elaborate systems of cooperation, which are harnessed to serve fictional aims and interests. Consequently, the system may seem to be working well, but only if we adopt the system's own criteria. For example, a Muslim mullah would say, "Our system works. There are now 1.5 billion Muslims worldwide, and more people study the Quran and submit themselves to Allah's will than ever before." The key question, though, is whether this is the right yardstick for measuring success. A school principal would say, "Our system works. During the last 5 years, exam results have risen by 7.3%. Yet, is that the best way to judge a school? An official in ancient Egypt would say, "Our system works. We collect more taxes, dig more canals, and build bigger pyramids than anyone else in the world." True enough, Pharaonic Egypt led the world in taxation, irrigation, and pyramid construction. But is that what really counts? People have many material, social, and mental needs. It is far from clear that peasants in ancient Egypt enjoyed more love or better social relations than their hunter-gatherer ancestors, and in terms of nutrition, health, and child mortality, it seems that life was actually worse. A document dated approximately 1850 BC, from the reign of Amenemhat III, the pharaoh who created Lake Fayum, tells of a well-to-do man called Dwar Keti, who took his son Pepi to school, so that he could learn to be a scribe. On the way to school, Dwar Keti portrayed the miserable life of peasants, laborers, soldiers, and artisans, so as to encourage Pepi to devote all his energy to studying, thereby escaping the destiny of most humans. According to Dwar Keti, the life of a landless field laborer is full of hardship and misery. Dressed in mere tatters, he works all day till his fingers are covered in blisters. Then Pharaoh's officials come and take him away to do forced labor. In return for all his hard work, he receives only sickness as payment. Even if he makes it home alive, he will be completely worn out and ruined. The fate of the landholding peasant is hardly better. He spends his days carrying water in buckets from the river to the field. The heavy load bends his shoulders and covers his neck with festering swellings. In the mornings he has to water his plot of leeks, in the afternoon his date palms, and in the evening his coriander field. Eventually he drops down and dies. The text might exaggerate things on purpose, but not by much. Pharaonic Egypt was the most powerful kingdom of its day, but for the simple peasant, all that power meant taxes and forced labor, rather than clinics and social security services. This was not a uniquely Egyptian defect. Despite all the immense achievements of the Chinese dynasties, the Muslim empires, and the European kingdoms, even in AD 1850, the life of the average person was not better, and might actually have been worse, than the lives of archaic hunter-gatherers. In 1850, a Chinese peasant, or a Manchester factory hand, worked longer hours than their hunter-gatherer ancestors. Their jobs were physically harder and mentally less fulfilling. Their diet was less balanced. Hygiene conditions were incomparably worse, and infectious diseases were far more common. Suppose you were given a choice between the following two vacation packages. Stone Age package. On day one, we will hike for 10 hours in a pristine forest, setting camp for the night in a clearing by a river. On day two, we will canoe down the river for 10 hours, camping on the shores of a small lake. On day three, we will learn from the native people how to fish in the lake and how to find mushrooms in the nearby woods. Modern proletarian package. On day one, we will work for 10 hours in a polluted textile factory, passing the night in a cramped apartment block. On day two, we will work for 10 hours as cashiers in the local department store, going back to sleep in the same apartment block. On day three, we will learn from the native people how to open a bank account and fill out mortgage forms. Which package would you choose? Hence, when we come to evaluate human cooperation networks, it all depends on the yardsticks and viewpoint we adopt. Are we judging pharaonic Egypt in terms of production, nutrition, or perhaps social harmony? Do we focus on the aristocracy, the simple peasants, or the pigs and crocodiles? History isn't a single narrative, but thousands of alternative narratives. Whenever we choose to tell one, we are also choosing to silence others. Human cooperative networks usually judge themselves by yardsticks of their own invention, and, not surprisingly, they often give themselves high marks. In particular, human networks built in the name of imaginary entities, such as gods, nations, and corporations, normally judge their success from the viewpoint of the imaginary entity. A religion is successful if it follows divine commandments to the letter. A nation is glorious if it promotes the national interest. And a corporation thrives if it makes a lot of money. When examining the history of any human network, it is therefore advisable to stop from time to time and look at things from the perspective of some real entity. How do you know if an entity is real? Very simple. Just ask yourself, can it suffer? When people burn down the temple of Zeus, Zeus doesn't suffer. When the euro loses its value, the euro doesn't suffer. When a bank goes bankrupt, the bank doesn't suffer. When a country suffers a defeat in war, the country doesn't really suffer. It's just a metaphor. In contrast, when a soldier is wounded in battle, he really does suffer. When a famished peasant has nothing to eat, she suffers. When a cow is separated from her newborn calf, she suffers. This is reality. Of course, suffering might well be caused by our belief in fictions. For example, belief in national and religious myths might cause the outbreak of war, in which millions lose their homes, their limbs, and even their lives. The cause of war is fictional, but the suffering is 100% real. This is exactly why we should strive to distinguish fiction from reality. Fiction isn't bad. It is vital. Without commonly accepted stories about things like money, states, or corporations, no complex human society can function. We can't play football unless everyone believes in the same made-up rules, and we can't enjoy the benefits of markets and courts without similar make-believe stories. But the stories are just tools. They should not become our goals or our yardsticks. When we forget that they are mere fiction, we lose touch with reality. then we begin entire wars, to make a lot of money for the corporation, or to protect the national interest. Corporations, money, and nations exist only in our imagination. We invented them to serve us. How come we find ourselves sacrificing our lives in their service? Chapter 5. The Odd Couple. Stories serve as the foundations and pillars of human societies. As history unfolded, stories about gods, nations, and corporations grew so powerful that they began to dominate objective reality. Believing in the great god Sobek, the mandate of heaven, or the Bible, enabled people to build Lake Fayum, the Great Wall of China, and Chartres Cathedral. Unfortunately, blind faith in these stories meant that human efforts frequently focused on increasing the glory of fictional entities such as gods and nations, instead of bettering the lives of real sentient beings. Does this analysis still hold true today? At first sight, it seems that modern society is very different from the kingdoms of ancient Egypt or medieval China. Hasn't the rise of modern science changed the basic rules of the human game? Wouldn't it be true to say that despite the ongoing importance of traditional myths, modern social systems rely increasingly on objective, scientific theories, such as the theory of evolution, which simply did not exist in ancient Egypt or medieval China? We could, of course, argue that scientific theories are a new kind of myth, and that our belief in science is no different from the ancient Egyptians' belief in the great god Sobek. Yet the comparison doesn't hold water. Sobek existed only in the collective imagination of his devotees. Praying to Sobek helped cement the Egyptian social system, thereby enabling people to build dams and canals that prevented floods and droughts. Yet the prayers themselves didn't raise or lower the Nile's water level by a millimeter. In contrast, scientific theories are not just a way to bind people together. It is often said that God helps those who help themselves. This is a roundabout way of saying that God doesn't exist, but if our belief in him inspires us to do something ourselves, it helps. Antibiotics, unlike God, help even those who don't help themselves. They cure infections whether you believe in them or not. Consequently, the modern world is very different from the pre-modern world. Egyptian pharaohs and Chinese emperors failed to overcome famine, plague, and war despite millennia of effort. Modern societies managed to do it within a few centuries. Isn't it the fruit of abandoning intersubjective myths in favor of objective scientific knowledge? And can't we expect this process to accelerate in the coming decades? As technology allows us to upgrade humans, overcome old age, and find the key to happiness, so people would care less about fictional gods, nations, and corporations, and focus instead on deciphering the physical and biological reality. In truth, however, things are far more complicated. Modern science certainly changed the rules of the game, but it did not simply replace myths with facts. Myths continue to dominate humankind. Science only makes these myths stronger. Instead of destroying the intersubjective reality, science will enable it to control the objective and subjective realities more completely than ever before. Thanks to computers and bioengineering, the difference between fiction and reality will blur, as people reshape reality to match their pet fictions. The priests of Sobek imagined the existence of divine crocodiles, while Pharaoh dreamt about immortality. In reality, the sacred crocodile was a very ordinary swamp reptile dressed in golden fineries, and Pharaoh was as mortal as the simplest of peasants. After death, his corpse was mummified using preservative balms and scented perfumes, but it was as lifeless as one can get. In contrast, 21st century scientists might be able to really engineer super crocodiles, and to provide the human elite with eternal youth here on Earth. Consequently, the rise of science will make at least some myths and religions mightier than ever. To understand why, and to face the challenges of the 21st century, we should therefore revisit one of the most nagging questions of all. How does modern science relate to religion? It seems that people have already said a million times everything there is to say about this question. Yet, in practice, science and religion are like a husband and wife who, after 500 years of marriage counselling, still don't know each other. He still dreams about Cinderella, and she keeps pining for Prince Charming, while they argue about whose turn it is to take out the rubbish. Germs and demons. Most of the misunderstandings regarding science and religion result from faulty definitions of religion. All too often, people confuse religion with superstition, spirituality, belief in supernatural powers, or belief in gods. Religion is none of these things. Religion cannot be equated with superstition, because most people are unlikely to call their cherished beliefs superstitions. We always believe in the truth. It's only other people who believe in superstitions. Similarly, few people put their faith in supernatural powers. For those who believe in demons, demons aren't supernatural. They are an integral part of nature, just like porcupines, scorpions, and germs. Modern physicians blame disease on invisible germs, and voodoo priests blame disease on invisible demons. There's nothing supernatural about it. You make some demon angry, so the demon enters your body and causes you pain. What could be more natural than that? Only those who don't believe in demons think of them as standing apart from the natural order of things. Equating religion with faith in supernatural powers implies that you can understand all known natural phenomena without religion, which is just an optional supplement. Having understood perfectly well the whole of nature, you can now choose whether to add some supernatural religious dogma or not. However, most religions argue that you simply cannot understand the world without them. You will never comprehend the true reason for disease, drought, or earthquakes if you do not take their dogma into account. Defining religion as belief in gods is also problematic. We tend to say that a devout Christian is religious because she believes in God, whereas a fervent communist isn't religious because communism has no gods. However, religion is created by humans rather than by gods, and it is defined by its social function rather than by the existence of deities. Religion is anything that confers superhuman legitimacy on human social structures. It legitimizes human norms and values by arguing that they reflect superhuman laws. Religion asserts that we humans are subject to a system of moral laws that we did not invent, and that we cannot change. A devout Jew would say that this is the system of moral laws created by God and revealed in the Bible. A Hindu would say that Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva created the laws, which were revealed to us humans in the Vedas. Other religions, from Buddhism and Taoism to Nazism, communism, and liberalism, argue that the superhuman laws are natural laws and not the creation of this or that God. Of course, each believes in a different set of natural laws discovered and revealed by different seers and prophets, from Buddha and Lao Tzu to Hitler and Lenin. A Jewish boy comes to his father and asks, "Dad, why shouldn't we eat pork?" The father strokes his long white beard thoughtfully and answers, "Well, Yankele, that's how the world works. You are still young and you don't understand, but if we eat pork, God will punish us and we will come to a bad end. It isn't my idea. It's not even the rabbi's idea. If the rabbi had created the world, maybe he would have created a world in which pork was perfectly kosher. But the rabbi didn't create the world. God did it. And God said, I don't know why, that we shouldn't eat pork. So we shouldn't. Capiche?" In 1943, a German boy comes to his father, a senior SS officer, and asks, "Dad, why are we killing the Jews?" The father puts on his shiny leather boots and meanwhile explains, "Well, Fritz, that's how the world works. You are still young and you don't understand, but if we allow the Jews to live, they will cause the degeneration and extinction of humankind. It's not my idea, and it's not even the Führer's idea, If Hitler had created the world, maybe he would have created a world in which the laws of natural selection did not apply, and Jews and Aryans could all live together in perfect harmony. But Hitler didn't create the world. He just managed to decipher the laws of nature, and then instructed us how to live in line with them. If we disobey these laws, we will come to a bad end. Is that clear? In 2016, a British boy comes to his father, a Liberal MP, and asks, "Dad, why should we care about the human rights of Muslims in the Middle East?" The father puts down his cup of tea, thinks for a moment, and says, "Well, Duncan, that's how the world works. You are still young and you don't understand, but all humans, even Muslims in the Middle East, have the same nature and therefore enjoy the same natural rights. This isn't my idea, nor a decision of Parliament. If Parliament had created the world, universal human rights might well have been buried in some subcommittee, along with all that quantum physics stuff. But Parliament didn't create the world. It just tries to make sense of it, and we must respect the natural rights even of Muslims in the Middle East, or very soon our own rights will also be violated, and we will come to a bad end. Now off you go." Liberals, communists, and followers of other modern creeds dislike describing their own system as a religion, because they identify religion with superstitions and supernatural powers. If you tell communists or liberals that they are religious, they think you accuse them of blindly believing in groundless pipe dreams. In fact, it means only that they believe in some system of moral laws that wasn't invented by humans, but which humans must nevertheless obey. As far as we know, all human societies believe in this. Every society tells its members that they must obey some superhuman moral law, and that breaking this law will result in catastrophe. Religions differ, of course, in the details of their stories, the concrete commandments, and the rewards and punishments they promise. Thus, in medieval Europe, the Catholic Church argued that God doesn't like rich people. Jesus said that it is harder for a rich man to pass through the gates of heaven than for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle, and the Church encouraged the rich to give lots of alms, threatening that misers will burn in hell. Modern communism also dislikes rich people, but it threatens them with class conflict here and now, rather than with burning sulfur after death. The communist laws of history are similar to the commandments of the Christian God, inasmuch as they are superhuman forces that humans cannot change at will. People can decide tomorrow morning to cancel the offside rule in football, because we invented that law and we are free to change it. However, at least according to Marx, we cannot change the laws of history. No matter what the capitalists do, as long as they continue to accumulate private property, they are bound to create class conflict, and they are destined to be defeated by the rising proletariat. If you happen to be a communist yourself, you might argue that communism and Christianity are nevertheless very different, because communism is right, whereas Christianity is wrong. Class conflict really is inherent in the capitalist system, whereas rich people don't suffer eternal tortures in hell after they die. Yet even if that's the case, it doesn't mean communism is not a religion. Rather, it means that communism is the one true religion. Followers of every religion are convinced that theirs alone is true. Perhaps the followers of one religion are right. If you meet the Buddha. The assertion that religion is a tool for preserving social order and for organizing large-scale cooperation may vex many people for whom it represents, first and foremost, a spiritual path. However, just as the gap between religion and science is smaller than we may commonly think, so the gap between religion and spirituality is much bigger. Religion is a deal, whereas spirituality is a journey. Religion gives a complete description of the world and offers us a well-defined contract with predetermined goals. God exists. He told us to behave in certain ways. If you obey God, you'll be admitted to heaven. If you disobey him, you'll burn in hell. The very clarity of this deal allows society to define common norms and values that regulate human behavior. Spiritual journeys are nothing like that. They usually take people in mysterious ways towards unknown destinations. The quest usually begins with some big question, such as, who am I? What is the meaning of life? What is good? Whereas many people just accept the ready-made answers provided by the powers that be, spiritual seekers are not so easily satisfied. They are determined to follow the big question wherever it leads, and not just to places you know well or wish to visit. Thus, for most people, academic studies are a deal rather than a spiritual journey, because they take us to a predetermined goal approved by our elders, governments, and banks. I'll study for 3 years, pass the exams, get my BA certificate, and secure a well-paid job. Academic studies might be transformed into a spiritual journey if the big questions you encounter on the way deflect you towards unexpected destinations, of which you could hardly even conceive at first. For example, a student might begin to study economics in order to secure a job in Wall Street. However, if what she learns somehow causes her to end up in a Hindu ashram or helping HIV patients in Zimbabwe, then we might call that a spiritual journey. Why label such a voyage spiritual? This is a legacy from ancient dualist religions that believed in the existence of two gods, one good and one evil. According to dualism, the good God created pure and everlasting souls that lived in a wonderful world of spirit. However, the bad God, sometimes named Satan, created another world, made of matter. Satan didn't know how to make his creation last. Hence, in the world of matter, everything rots and disintegrates. In order to breathe life into his defective creation, Satan tempted souls from the pure world of spirit and locked them up inside material bodies. That's what humans are, a good spiritual soul trapped inside an evil material body. Since the soul's prison, the body, decays and eventually dies, Satan ceaselessly tempts the soul with bodily delights, and above all with food, sex, and power. When the body disintegrates and the soul has a chance to escape back to the spiritual world, its craving for bodily pleasures draws it back inside some new material body. The soul thus transmigrates from body to body, wasting its days in pursuit of food, sex, and power. Dualism instructs people to break these material shackles and undertake a journey back to the spiritual world, which is totally unfamiliar to us, but is our true home. During this quest, we must reject all material temptations and deals. Due to this dualist legacy, every journey on which we doubt the conventions and deals of the mundane world and walk towards an unknown destination is called a spiritual journey. Such journeys are fundamentally different from religions, because religions seek to cement the worldly order, whereas spirituality seeks to escape it. Often enough, the most important demand from spiritual wanderers is to challenge the beliefs and conventions of dominant religions. In Zen Buddhism, it is said that, if you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. Which means that if, while walking on the spiritual path, you encounter the rigid ideas and fixed laws of institutionalized Buddhism, you must free yourself from them too. For religions, spirituality is a dangerous threat. Religions typically strive to rein in the spiritual quest of their followers, and many religious systems were challenged not by lay people preoccupied with food, sex, and power, but rather by spiritual truth-seekers who wanted more than platitudes. Thus, the Protestant revolt against the authority of the Catholic Church was ignited not by hedonistic atheists, but rather by a devout and ascetic monk, Martin Luther. Luther wanted answers to the existential questions of life, and refused to settle for the rites, rituals, and deals offered by the Church. In Luther's day, the Church promised its followers very enticing deals. If you sinned and feared eternal damnation in the afterlife, all you needed to do was buy an indulgence. In the early 16th century, the Church employed professional salvation peddlers, who wandered the towns and villages of Europe and sold indulgences for fixed prices. You want an entry visa to heaven? Pay 10 gold coins. You want Grandpa Heinz and Grandma Gertrude to join you there? No problem, but it will cost you 30 coins. The most famous of these peddlers, the Dominican friar Johannes Tetzel, allegedly said that the moment the coin clinks in the money chest, the soul flies out of purgatory to heaven. The more Luther thought about it, the more he doubted this deal and the church that offered it. You cannot just buy your way to salvation. The Pope couldn't possibly have the authority to forgive people.